Chapter 36. Siteman got the better of him. After leaving the railway station, he had an ice and read the paper in a cafe. Then he went back to the hotel, dressed for dinner, and dined with a good appetite. After dinner he lingered in the hall. There were chairs and tables there, smoking his cigar, talked to the little girl of the primo tenor of the San Carlo Theater, and exchanged a few words with that amiable lady, the wife of the primo tenor. There was no performance that evening, and these people were going to the villa also. They went out of the hotel. Very well. At the moment of following their example, it was 9:30 already. He remembered he had a rather large sum of money in his pocketbook. He entered, therefore, the office and deposited the greater part of it with the bookkeeper of the hotel. This done, he took a carrozzella and drove to the seashore. He got out of the cab and entered the villa on foot from the Largo di Vittoria end. He stared at me very hard. And I understood then how really impressionable he was. Every small fact and event of that evening stood out in his memory, as if endowed with mystic significance. If he did not mention to me the color of the pony which drew the carrozzella, and the aspect of the man who drove, it was a mere oversight arising from his agitation, which he repressed manfully. He had then entered the Villa Nazionale from the Largo di Vittoria end. The Villa Nazionale is a public pleasure ground laid out in grass plots, bushes, and flower beds between the houses of the Riviera di Chioggia and the waters of the bay. Alleys of trees, more or less parallel, stretch its whole length, which is considerable. On the Riviera di Chioggia side, the electric tramcars run close to the railings. Between the garden and the sea is the fashionable drive, a broad road bordered by a low wall, beyond which the Mediterranean splashes with gentle murmurs when the weather is fine. As life goes on late at night in Naples, the broad drive was all astir with a brilliant swarm of carriage lamps moving in pairs, some creeping slowly, others running rapidly under the thin motionless line of electric lamps defining the shore. And a brilliant swarm of stars hung above the land, humming with voices, piled up with houses, glittering with lights, and over the silent flat shadows of the sea. The gardens themselves are not very well lit. Our friend went forward in the warm gloom, his eyes fixed upon a distant luminous region extending nearly across the whole width of the villa, as if the air had glowed there with its own cold, bluish, and dazzling light. This magic spot, behind the black trunks of trees and masses of inky foliage, breathed out sweet sounds mingled with bursts of brassy roar, sudden clashes of metal, and grave, vibrating thuds. As he walked on, all these noises combined together into a piece of elaborate music whose harmonious phrases came persuasively through a great disorderly murmur of voices and shuffling of feet on the gravel of that open space. An enormous crowd immersed in the electric light, as if in a bath of some radiant and tenuous fluid shed upon their heads by luminous globes, drifted in its hundreds round the band. Hundreds more sat on chairs in more or less concentric circles, receiving unflinchingly the great waves of sonority that ebbed out into the darkness. The Count penetrated the throng, drifted with it in tranquil enjoyment, listening and looking at the faces. All people of good society, mothers with their daughters, parents and children, young men and young women, all talking, smiling, nodding to each other. Very many pretty faces, and very many pretty toilets. There was, of course, a quantity of diverse types. Showy old fellows with white mustaches, fat men, thin men, officers in uniform, but what predominated, he told me, was the South Italian type of young man, with a colorless, clear complexion, red lips, jet-black little mustache and liquid black eyes, so wonderfully effective in leering or scowling. Withdrawing from the throng, the Count shared a little table in front of the cafe with a young man of just such a type. Our friend had some lemonade. The young man was sitting moodily before an empty glass. He looked up once, and then looked down again. He also tilted his hat forward. Like this, the Count made the gesture of a man pulling his hat down over his brow, and went on. I think to myself, he is sad. Something is wrong with him. Young men have their troubles. I take no notice of him, of course. I pay for my lemonade, and go away. Strolling about in the neighborhood of the band, the Count thinks he saw twice that young man wandering alone in the crowd. Once their eyes met, it must have been the same young man, but there were so many there of that type that he could not be certain. Moreover, he was not very much concerned except in so far that he had been struck by the marked, peevish discontent of that face. Presently, tired of the feeling of confinement one experiences in a crowd, the Count edged away from the band. An alley, very somber by contrast, presented itself invitingly with its promise of solitude and coolness. He entered it, walking slowly until the sound of the orchestra became distinctly deadened. Then he walked back and turned about once more. He did this several times, before he noticed that there was somebody occupying one of the benches. The spot being midway between two lamp posts, the light was faint. The man lolled back in the corner of the seat, his legs stretched out, his arms folded and his head drooping on his breast. He never stirred, as though he had fallen asleep there, but when the Count passed by next time he had changed his attitude. He sat leaning forward. His elbows were propped on his knees, and his hands were rolling a cigarette. He never looked up from that occupation. The Count continued his stroll away from the band. He returned slowly, he said. I can imagine him enjoying to the full, but with his usual tranquility, the balminess of this southern night, and the sounds of music softened delightfully by the distance. Presently, he approached for the third time the man on the garden seat, still leaning forward with his elbows on his knees. It was a dejected pose. In the semi-obscurity of the alley, his high shirt collar and his cuffs made small patches of vivid whiteness. The Count said that he had noticed him getting up brusquely, as if to walk away, but almost before he was aware of it, the man stood before him asking in a low, gentle tone whether the signer would have the kindness to oblige him with a light. The Count answered this request by a polite urtainly, and dropped his hands with the intention of exploring both pockets of his trousers for the matches. I dropped my hands, he said, but I never put them in my pockets. I felt a pressure there. He put the tip of his finger on a spot close under his breastbone, the very spot of the human body where a Japanese gentleman begins the operations of the harakiri, which is a form of suicide following upon dishonor, upon an intolerable outrage to the delicacy of one's feelings. I glanced down, the Count continued in an awestruck voice, and what do I see? A knife. A long knife, you don't mean to say, I exclaimed, amazed, that you have been held up like this in the villa at 10:30, within a stone's throw of 1,000 people. He nodded several times, staring at me with all his might. The clarionet, he declared, solemnly, was finishing his solo, and I assure you I could hear every note. Then the band crashed fortissimo, and that creature rolled its eyes, and gnashed its teeth, hissing at me with the greatest ferocity, "Be silent!" No noiser, I could not get over my astonishment. What sort of knife was it? I asked, stupidly. A long blade. A stiletto, perhaps a kitchen knife. A long narrow blade. It gleamed. And his eyes gleamed. His white teeth too. I could see them. He was very ferocious. I thought to myself, if I hit him, he will kill me. How could I fight with him? He had the knife, and I had nothing. I am nearly 70, you know, and that was a young man. I seemed even to recognize him. The moody young man of the cafe. The young man I met in the crowd. But I could not tell. There are so many like him in this country. The distress of that moment was reflected in his face. I should think that physically he must have been paralyzed by surprise. His thoughts, however, remained extremely active. They ranged over every alarming possibility. The idea of setting up a vigorous shouting for help occurred to him too. But he did nothing of the kind, and the reason why he refrained gave me a good opinion of his mental self-possession. He saw in a flash that nothing prevented the other from shouting too. That young man might in an instant have thrown away his knife and pretended I was the aggressor. Why not? He might have said I attacked him. Why not? It was one incredible story against another. He might have said anything, bring some dishonoring charge against me, what do I know? By his dress he was no common robber. He seemed to belong to the better classes. What could I say? He was an Italian, I am a foreigner. Of course, I have my passport, and there is our consul, but to be arrested, dragged at night to the police office like a criminal. He shuddered. It was in his character to shrink from scandal, much more than from mere death. And certainly for many people this would have always remained, considering certain peculiarities of Neapolitan manners, a deucedly queer story. The Count was no fool. His belief in the respectable placidity of life having received this rude shock, he thought that now anything might happen. But also a notion came into his head that this young man was perhaps merely an infuriated lunatic. This was for me the first hint of his attitude towards this adventure. In his exaggerated delicacy of sentiment, he felt that nobody's self-esteem need be affected by what a madman may choose to do to one. It became apparent, however, that the Count was to be denied that consolation. He enlarged upon the abominably savage way in which that young man rolled his glistening eyes and gnashed his white teeth. The band was going now through a slow movement of solemn braying by all the trombones, with deliberately repeated bangs of the big drum. "But what did you do?" I asked, greatly excited. "Nothing," answered the Count. I let my hands hang down very still. I told him quietly I did not intend making a noise. He snarled like a dog, then said in an ordinary voice, "Vostro portfolio." Apostrophe, so I naturally, continued the Count, and from this point acted the whole thing in pantomime. Holding me with his eyes, he went through all the motions of reaching into his inside breast pocket, taking out a pocketbook, and handing it over. But that young man, still bearing steadily on the knife, refused to touch it. He directed the Count to take the money out himself, received it into his left hand, motioned the pocketbook to be returned to the pocket, all this being done to the sweet thrilling of flutes and clarionets sustained by the emotional drone of the hautboys. And the young man, as the Count called him, said, "Colin, this seems very little." It was, indeed, only 340 or 360 lire, the Count pursued. I had left my money in the hotel, as you know. I told him this was all I had on me. He shook his head impatiently and said, "Vostro orologio." Apostrophe, the Count gave me the dumb show of pulling out his watch, detaching it. But, as it happened, the valuable gold half-chronometer he possessed had been left at a watchmaker's for cleaning. He wore that evening on a leather guard the Waterbury 50-franc thing he used to take with him on his fishing expeditions. Perceiving the nature of this booty, the well-dressed robber made a contemptuous clicking sound with his tongue like this, "Siah!" and waved it away hastily. Then, as the Count was returning the disdained object to his pocket, he demanded with a threateningly increased pressure of the knife on the epigastrium, by way of reminder, "Vostrianelli." Apostrophe, one of the rings, went on the Count, was given me many years ago by my wife. The other is the signet ring of my father. I said, "No, that you shall not have." Apostrophe, here the Count reproduced the gesture corresponding to that declaration, by clapping one hand upon the other, and pressing both thus against his chest. It was touching in its resignation. "T that you shall not have," he repeated, firmly, and closed his eyes, fully. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.